The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. Coming up in the Book Nook this morning, we'll be talking to Tom Stanton. He has written quite a book. Back in the mid-1930s in Detroit, there were some great sports teams. There was also a very evil terrorist organization. We're going to hear all about it. The book is Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. Tom Stanton's going to tell us all about it in the Book Nook. But first, National Public Radio news. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Tom Stanton. Hello, Tom.
Thanks, Vic. It's good to be with you.
Tom, you've got a new book out. It's called Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. Now, I had been aware of at least the Tigers, the Detroit Tigers baseball team, and their winning the World Series in that particular year, but all this other stuff was new to me. I'm not a hockey fan. I don't really follow professional football, and I had never heard of this terror group in Detroit. Whoa, what a story. How did you decide to write about this?
You know, it took a long time for me to come to that decision, and this story was actually planted in my childhood. Believe it or not, I was a sports-obsessed kid and growing up in early 70s Detroit area. And the holidays, my dad's large Polish Catholic family would come to our home in the suburbs, and amid the twinkling lights in the basement and, you know, the smell of kielbasa and sauerkraut and lasagna wafting on the air, they'd reminisce about their childhoods. And many of their stories were set in the mid-30s when they were coming of age, or young men and women. And I used to be so envious when they'd tell the sports part of the story, that within a seventh-month period, the Tigers won the World Series, the Detroit Lions won the NFL title, the Detroit Red Wings won the Stanley Cup, and at the same time, Joe Louis, the phenomenal, well-known boxer, was the uncrowned, undefeated champion of boxing. He had not yet had a shot because they were reluctant to let a black man after the Jack Johnson experience have a shot. But he was on the rise and had become a national figure. So those four things together, along with a lot of other smaller and less known titles, led to Detroit being proclaimed the City of Champions. So I knew about that, and my dad, till his passing a year and a half ago, could still recite the lineup of the 1935 Tigers, the team he was 15 years old when they won the very first World Series championship in Detroit. And so I knew that story. And then occasionally there'd be a little darker story that one of my uncles would tell related to the Black Legion. And he would tell it kind of in a comical way, believe it or not. But he would tell it lighthearted, and what he would say was when he was a young man, his early 20s, he was walking with some of his artistic friends in the black neighborhood of Detroit, Paradise Valley, when this car pulled up beside them and asked what they were doing in the neighborhood. There were two white guys in the car, and they identified themselves as undercover cops, but my uncle didn't believe them, and they kind of challenged the two guys until the guys pulled guns and ordered them into their unmarked car. And my uncle thought, as he retold the story, that he was being driven away by the infamous Knight Riders, the infamous Black Legion, and that he thought for sure that he was heading off to his death. And so, you know, I had heard about the Black Legion early on, and over the years investigating other books, I would have eventually occasionally come upon other mentions, magazine stories, a mention in a chapter or two, and just decided finally that, you know, I wanted to tell the story. I think most people who are aware of early 30s history probably have heard of the Purple Gang, which was a rum-running, profit-making gang. But the Black Legion was much more nefarious. They were kind of like a clan on steroids, and they were operating secretively below the surface. And I wanted that story to finally be told.
And their leader lived in Lima, Ohio.
That's right. Much of the story takes place in the Detroit area, where the Legion was exceptionally strong, but it has a rich history in Ohio, much of which hasn't been explored because there were public officials who were involved in it, including police officials, and Bert Effinger was the man who was heading it up. He was technically second in command, but I think it was just a matter of his having taken over the Legion from a doctor in Bel Air, Ohio, and just kind of elevated him into a figurehead role. But it was really Effinger who was running the thing in the among Legionnaires. There's thoughts among many that there were other silent leaders, better educated men who were responsible for what this organization was doing. But Effinger became the public face of it once it was exposed in 36. Prior to that point, the FBI had been to Lima numerous times to investigate, but once to interview him. They had been receiving reports since probably 34 that something was happening in Lima where the Legion controlled some of the public offices. They controlled some of the public works jobs. And Effinger, who was just an electrician, just kind of getting by, wasn't getting rich in any sense, was the figurehead. And he had once run for sheriff. Actually ran twice for sheriff of the county and got defeated both times. Both before and after John Dillinger escaped and the killing of the sheriff out that way.
Tom Stanton joins us on the program today. His new book is Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. Okay, we're going to talk about the bad guys first, and then we'll get to the sports heroes. Tell our listeners what these people were doing. I mean, they remind you a lot of the Klan because they hated Jews, they hated Catholics, they hated blacks, and they were so deeply enmeshed in the power structure that their misdeeds were frequently ignored.
They told their inductees that they had friends in high places, and the inductees saw things that indicated that was true to them, and so they were fearful of their lives. What would happen, Vic, is that if you were a white Protestant male, you might have a friend, a buddy, who'd ask you, you know, want to go to a card game, want to go to a barbecue, you know, some friends who are true Americans are getting together, you know, we're going to have a bonfire, and you'd be invited to some kind of gathering, and it'd be later in the evening. At some point, if you were in a church basement or a temple hall, the lights might go out and suddenly be a red light, and perhaps it would be shining on some weapons, and you would discover that you're surrounded by men in black robes and hoods with skulls and crossbones on them. And if you thought it was humorous, thought wouldn't last very long, because very soon you would be taking a death oath, the Black Oath, vowing to give your life, vowing to do whatever your Legion masters ordered you to do, and you would find that you had quickly been inducted. Out of fear, you might have gone along. A great likelihood you did go along, because often they would have either faked a hanging or actually beaten somebody who had resisted, and you would be fearful for your life. You'd be terrified, and you would agree, with this gun pointed at your heart to take the oath. Mm. And once you did, it was very difficult to extricate yourself from the Black Legion. You would maybe, if you didn't really agree with what they were doing, you would perhaps just stop going to meetings. But then at some point, a group would come to your house and inquire why you haven't been going. And if you put up too much of a fuss, you could potentially be taken out to a field and lashed. It was a group that ruled by terror. Mm. And they had all of the usual biases, as the Klan did. But they also got worked into the anti-union movement in a big way. Effinger used to like to say, once they were exposed, that they were against the isms, against unionism, against progressivism, against socialism, communism, Judaism, Catholicism, Negroism. The one ism they liked, they said, was Americanism, and they viewed themselves as adhering to a strict constitutional view.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Tom Stanton, and we're talking about his new book, Terror in the City of Champions: Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. And there's a gentleman whose activities are tracked fairly thoroughly in this story, a man named Dayton Dean, and we're going to talk about him right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest on the program today is Tom Stanton. We're talking about the Black Legion, and the book is Terror in the City of Champions: Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. You follow the movements of a guy named Dayton Dean, who's a member of the Black Legion. What a strange guy, because he seems to have an immunity from being punished for not accomplishing his deeds that he's been assigned. They keep telling him to kill this person or kill that person. He never seems to quite get around to it.
Yeah, he's an interesting study. Dayton is leading a pretty mundane life. He's a pipe wrapper at the lighting company power plant in southwest Detroit, along the Detroit River. And, he did serve some time in the Navy, liked to brag about the fact that during the race riots in Washington, D.C., and during the era of World War One, or right after it, that he had shot some folks under orders from his commander. So he considered himself a good soldier. And when he gets inducted into the Black Legion, some men are terrified when this happens because they have no idea what they've just gotten themselves involved in. Dayton Dean, on the other hand, actually likes it. He agrees with a lot of their stances, but not only that, it's the excitement of it. The masks and hoods and the gowns and the late night meetings out in fields or huge halls, and the chance to do a little brutality. But you're right, he keeps getting these assignments that he does not succeed at. But it's his fervor, his willingness to do the crimes. And because he does commit a whole series, and he's involved in at least two murders, but there are a whole lot of others that he does not take to their logical conclusion. Logical, wrong word.
Yeah, and you have some photos of him in the book, and he really looks like a thug. And these photos indicate, and the story tells us, that he finally got caught, and he decided to sing like a canary.
He did, yeah. He's in it a good 3 years before that takes place. And I think at some point he started he's not a very bright guy, okay? And I think that's why the Legion thought they could use it. But he, I think, just finally realized that, he was being set up on a lot of this stuff. His Legion bosses were including him in a variety of crimes, and often they would involve a group of guys so that, you know, everybody would have some responsibility for what took place and make them thus less likely to go to the police, who, as it turned out, had folks who were in there as well. And so he, you know, he eventually, in the final murder that's going to lead to the exposure of the Black Legion, he, by that point, has doubts about what he's doing. But he had been assigned, as you mentioned, to assassinate a newspaper publisher, to assassinate a liberal lawyer, even moved into that man's apartment complex, and had been assigned to kill a mayor in a suburban city, in Ecorse, an industrial city. He failed at those, but he wasn't totally to blame. There were other considerations. They did successfully bomb the home of the mayor, and he showed that he had concern for others, believe it or not. I mean, it's terrible to say that, but everybody is nuanced, and his concern was he didn't, in the case of the attorney, he didn't want to just blow up an apartment complex when some kids across the hall could get hurt, too. And so that was the reason he didn't get to the attorney in time, and then as it happened, the attorney who was running for office lost, and so he became less of an issue for the Legion. Legion, by the way, was organized into regiments, kind of a military situation, and a full regiment had about 1,600 men in it. We're not sure, because this was a secret society, how many regiments there were in southeast Detroit. I believe there were probably 12 to 14. There were also a lot of regiments in Lima, and, you know, Findlay, and Toledo was a Legion stronghold. So they were throughout Ohio, Michigan, and Indiana were where they were strongest. But I can, you know, we can head off and talk a bit about some specific crimes, if you like, that Dean was involved in, and kind of gives you a sense of just the range that the Legion was involved in. You know, some of it was petty stuff. You might be a member who's missing some meetings, or maybe you have a Catholic housekeeper and they want you to fire her. And so you might get lashed while tied to a tree. They might lash you for some jealousy reason. A lot was determined by the individual leaders of whatever regiment you belong to. And then there were the graver crimes.
Well, as you mentioned, or as you implied, this one gentleman, the would-be assassin, was a killer with a conscience. So he did have opportunities, and he would see this person he was supposed to kill, and he'd say, well, he's holding a baby or whatever. You know, he's like, this isn't the right time. And he's a fascinating character, but I think in the interest of brevity, we should probably segue into the more pleasant parts of this. I should note that you are a known baseball fan and writer. You're the author of books like The Final Season, Ty and the Babe, The Road to Cooperstown, Hank Aaron and the Home Run That Changed America. So it should come as no surprise to readers that there is a ton of baseball in here. And let's talk about this team, because the Black Legion, they were fans too.
You know, Detroit in 1933, the heart of the Depression, had an unemployment rate of about 40%. And so when the Tigers started winning in 34 and getting into the World Series where they lost and then continued that winning into 1935, the city was just, it just gave the city something to feel good about, and people were so excited, including Black Legion members who planned some of their crimes so they didn't overlap with games. And the great irony is that two of the stars, two of the biggest stars on the Detroit team, were very vocal members of two religious groups that the Legion hated.
Mm-hmm.
Hank Greenberg, who is the slugging first baseman, is a Jewish icon today, and was at that time the most famous Jewish athlete in the country. And then locally, more of a local fame, Hall of Famer, though, nonetheless, Charlie Gehringer was the second baseman, a very religious Catholic man who went to church every day and was unmarried because he was taking care of his sickly mother. And he was just kind of that image that if you were a Catholic boy who wanted to love baseball and your mom didn't really want you to, you could point to Charlie Gehringer as a, you know, as a good role model. And so you have these two guys leading the team that the Legionnaires are rooting for, though in other circumstances they hate Jews and they hate Catholics. And the team is led by Mickey Cochran, who's such an interesting figure. I don't mean this in a flippant way, but if he were managing today, he no doubt would be on mood-altering medication because he is a very manic personality, extreme highs, extreme lows, so much to the point that he suffered a nervous breakdown partway through the 1936 season after they had won the World Series when the stress just became so great. And so those three, along with one other player I'd love to mention because he's just so fun, a guy who became a national figure at the time but is mostly forgotten today, a guy named Schoolboy Rowe.
Mm-hmm.
Schoolboy in 1934 is winning 10, 11, 12, 13 games in a row, 14, 15, working his way toward the record in the American League of 16 straight victories. And so the whole nation's attention is turned to him. And he makes an appearance on the most popular radio show of the time, Rudy Valley Show, and he reads a scripted line that's going to follow him for the rest of his life, till his dying days, literally. He says, using this little kind of country boy image of his, "How am I doing, Ma? How am I doing, Edna?" on the radio, and Edna being his high school sweetheart that he's engaged to. For the rest of his career, whenever he appears, fans are yelling, "How am I doing, Edna?" Edna became a nationally known figure as well for just a brief time there with Page One columns, and eventually married. But it's a sweet love story that runs through there as well, as Detroit is just going absolutely crazy with the winning Tigers.
Yeah, you really get into the psychology of a lot of these people. The player manager, it should be noted that Mickey Cochran was the catcher and did play. And Hank Greenberg, you know, this guy, he went through some psychological stuff. And, man, what a season. What did he drive in, 170 runs that one year? Unbelievable.
Yeah, pretty close, yeah. You know, we take for granted today that, you know, for the most part, an athlete who's Jewish isn't going to be ridiculed on the field. But he was enduring all sorts of, you know, incredible heckling from the other teams, just anti-Semitic stuff. A lot of people think he kind of, in fact, he and Jackie Robinson had a bit of a relationship later on when Jackie was coming into the major leagues and breaking the color barrier. He saw in Hank Greenberg, who by that point was pretty much done with most of his career anyway, an ally, and a guy that he could ask about the experience and what he had gone through. Because Greenberg, you know, he's battling bigots wherever he plays. You know, there's always somebody in the stand yelling, "Throw him a pork chop," or you know, using some slang derogatory term to refer to him. Other teams are doing it, too. It was much more common back in that day for teams to have hecklers, people who would try to get under the skin of their opponents. You don't see that much in baseball anymore, but heckling was a big part of the game among the teams. And they were incredibly, incredibly harsh on him, particularly in the early years of his career, 33, 34, 35. He endured a whole lot.
Hank answered with his bat.
Indeed he did, and it was the best way to answer.
Tom Stanton joins us. His book is Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. We still need to talk about football and hockey and boxing, so which one do you want to do next?
Well, we can probably make a short work of football and hockey. They play a role in the book, and They were a big part of what was happening at the time, but by far the Tigers and Joe Louis and boxing were the significant, the big significant ones. Hockey tended to, it was incredibly important in Detroit, but it tended at that time to be much more of a regional sport that was popular in the Northeast and in Canada. And in Detroit, being across the Detroit River from Ontario, drew a lot of Canadian fans. But the Red Wings, well, why don't we take them chronological? Well, the Lions, the Detroit Lions, at that point, college football by far was much more popular than professional football, which was a fledgling organization. And so we wouldn't recognize professional football in the 1930s based on how it looks today. The Lions played at the University of Detroit football field, and frequently the University of Detroit football team could outdraw the Detroit Lions team. Mm. But their best-known player was a guy named Dutch Clark. And if you know Dutch Clark at all, you probably would recognize him for a famous portrait that appeared, I think, in Life magazine, side profile of this strong-jawed football player. It's a iconic photo. The football of that era, again, it was a game that was played differently from what we're used to, equipment-wise, a whole lot less the players had on. But nonetheless, that was the Lions won the championship weeks after the Tigers had won the World Series, and then the following spring. And that, so we're talking about a seven-month period from October 35 into April of 36, when the Red Wings then won the Stanley Cup. And that is where they got the City of Champions tag. Hockey was huge in certain parts of the country, including Detroit. And so I would say, actually, of those three, it was baseball most important, hockey second, football to a lesser degree. But you meanwhile have Joe Louis, and that's really a spectacular story in my view. This Louis, a young boxer who had moved to Detroit with his family from Alabama and, you know, had tried working in the auto plants a bit, all while pursuing boxing, and rose up through the Gold Gloves championships to become a pro in 34, maybe 35. I'm doing this from memory. And he is undefeated as a pro for his first 19 fights, and he is becoming, as his success grows, he's becoming more and more of an emblem in the African American community, in particular, often on the front page of the black newspapers. And if he goes into New York or Chicago, the black bell caps are carrying them on their shoulders, and if he heads into Harlem, he's a marquee name there, and he's important not just for the sports part, but for what he's meaning to race relations. He's breaking down some walls. There had been previously a black boxing champion who was very controversial, and as a result, Joe Louis didn't get a shot at the title for a long time. And that was Jack Johnson, who, after he won a fight against a well-known white boxer, saw riots occurring nationwide, and so boxing was unwilling for a long time to give another black boxer an opportunity.
Yeah, wow. He's... really quite a character, the young Joe Louis in this story. And was that 20th fight, the one against Max Schmeling?
Yeah, the first Max Schmeling fight in June of 36. And oddly, it happens in the same month that the other man most responsible for Detroit being City of Champions, Mickey Cochran, has his nervous breakdown. Joe Louis loses his first match. And so that City of Champions era really comes to a crushing halt right then. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of a exclamation point on it. And no city before or since has had that kind of the level of athletic success within that condensed period of time as Detroit did. Joe Louis, of course, will go on to recover and become the heavyweight champion, and in many folks' eyes, the greatest heavyweight champion of all time. You get some argument with Ali and some others. Mm-hmm. But Louis, in order to get that shot, though, his managers came up with a list of things he could and could not do because they wanted him to be the anti-Jack Johnson. And so, you know, you couldn't, one of his rules was he couldn't appear with a white woman in public alone. He had to be careful about going out to the bars and who he was dating. None of this means he wasn't very active and, you know, enjoying the opportunities that his fame and fortune brought him. He did. He just had to be very careful about it. He wasn't allowed to gloat over anybody he defeated. He was supposed to be very humble and, you know, he played the part. You would see staged press photos of him reading from his Bible and, you know, and photos of him visiting his mom and, you know, just stuff to enhance his image to make him seem less threatening.
I love the fact that Joe Louis was a Detroit Tigers baseball fan. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and my guest on the program today is Tom Stanton. We're talking about his new book, Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. The Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. We produce the Book Nook in the studios of WYSO every week, and it comes to you on Saturday mornings during the 7 o'clock hour and on Sunday mornings at 10:30. My guest today has written a book called Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. Tom Stanton joins us by telephone. And this Secret Society, this Black Legion, they kept getting attention from the authorities, but then the authorities just kind of went, nah, that doesn't raid our interest. And J. Edgar Hoover, throughout this entire book, keeps hearing about the Black Legion, but he doesn't seem to think that they merit the FBI's attention. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's one of the issues I attempt to tackle and make sense of. You know, the mid-30s, the FBI is really at its peak in terms of cultural popularity. They've gotten rid of some big-name bank robbers and culprits, Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde and Babyface Nelson, a whole list of them. And so everybody's talking about the G-Men, and there are, you know, movies and radio serials, and they're incredibly popular. But there's a postal inspector, and postal inspectors used to have more of a legal role, investigative role, who hears about this secret society in Lima, Ohio, and he writes this lengthy letter telling what he knows to J. Edgar Hoover, and he drops a note in there that this group is saying that there are 50 Department of Justice employees who belong. And we don't know if that's true, but that's what this letter indicated, and Hoover initially responds, you know, forwards it on to the Attorney General and says, just making you aware of this. The letter makes its way up the command, and he said, but, you know, there's nobody belongs. The Attorney General doesn't appreciate this response, sends it back and says, you know, you haven't even done an investigation. You know, look into this. There's a serious accusation here. And, you know, it takes some time. They look into it, and they never really explore that thoroughly. You know, finally, under some pressure, the FBI sends a guy out to interview Effinger, and he has the agent has a very derogatory view of Effinger as a kind of a blowhard and just exaggerating things. And they close they close out the case weeks before the murder of Charles Poole, which is going to lead to the exposure, the murder of this WPA worker, by Dayton Dean and under direct orders from his bosses in the Legion. And even after that happens, even after there's talk that the governments in the various Ohio and Michigan states are riddled with Legion members, Hoover has little interest. I looked through 900-plus pages of FBI files, as well as a whole lot of other archives and Michigan State Police files. But the FBI files are interesting because somebody will write in with information about the Black Legion, somebody they know who's involved, some government figure. There was an editor in Flint who wrote in about people there who are in the Legion talking about assassinating FDR. And in that case, Hoover forwarded to the version of the Secret Service then. But most cases, Hoover's just responding with, not our area, we don't have legal authority to investigate. Even when a state police captain in Michigan presses him on that issue, because there's a case where one body, a lot of the killings of the Black Legion were fake suicides, but a case where one body was taken in across international waters to an island in Canada, Hoover doesn't want to investigate that either. And that is certainly a case involving international waters where it would seem that the FBI would have authority, no doubt. My thought is that it probably didn't make sense politically for Hoover, who was building up power at this point, to investigate, because in Michigan and other Midwest states, it tended to be conservative Republicans, albeit in this case ones who had gone off the tracks, who were leading the Black Legion. However, if you were going to investigate the Black Legion, then you probably should be looking into the Klan down south as well. And at that point, the Klan was very much part of the Democratic Party voting bloc, part of the Southern strategy the Democrats had. And so Hoover might have figured, this is dangerous territory. I'm going to get it from both sides. Another possibility is that, probably except for the murders they were committing politically, being against communism, being against socialism, being against unionism, fit with Hoover's political viewpoint as well. And so, I juggle that because it's, if there are even now, through my Freedom of Information Act request, there is stuff that is marked off of the files. So, 80 years later, it's still not all public. And it's not clear why Hoover didn't want to investigate fully. But he was aware of the Black Legion since its earliest days in the late 20s in Bel Air, Ohio.
Wow, there's still stuff that's blacked out, huh? Those are probably the photos of Clyde Tolson and J. Edgar. My guest is Tom Stanton. And was it the pool killing where he was left in Canada?
No, that was another one which nobody was ever convicted of. It involves a guy named Roy Pidcock.
I remember.
It happened the same night as the pool killing.
Okay.
And the police just dismissed it as a... as a suicide.
That's right.
I should add that one of the things I uncovered was that the Detroit Police Commissioner was a member of the Black Legion. I don't know, in the case of a lot of these public figures who were using it for votes and for political power, that they were aware of murders being undertaken in their name. I'm not sure how much they knew of the crimes, but there were a lot of high-level people who belonged. And that's why so few people were convicted. They were convicted based on Dayton Dean talking. And other than the crimes that Dayton Dean committed and testified about, very few were prosecuted. In fact, Bert Effinger never spent a day in jail. He avoided even being extradited, went undercover for about a year. The Black Legion case broke in 1936. Spring, summer of 1936, people were being prosecuted into 1936-37. Effinger would finally face trial. They'd finally bring him to Michigan, or would try to make him face trial in 1939. By that point, they couldn't find a lot of witnesses. They couldn't, and others were refusing to testify. So the thought among one Legionnaire who talked to the FBI was that there were just too many higher-up people, and that they helped him to keep him from going on the stand.
The book is Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society That Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. Tom Stanton wrote it. He joins us on the program today. And this book was helpful to me in that it gave me a sense of perspective, because we see all this senseless, hate-fueled violence in our current society, in our culture, these terrible things going on, brutal killings, horrors. And then we read that in 1935 in Detroit, they were doing terrible, horrible things, that humanity hasn't changed much. In your book, I think the most horrific thing to me was the killing of Silas Coleman. What terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah, it was just for fun, which is just unfathomable. I mean, those of us who live what we think is a decent life have trouble understanding any of these crimes. But Silas Coleman was an African-American laborer, and it was simply a matter of the local commander of one of the regiments that Dayton Dean belonged to, Harvey Davis, his co-worker at the power plant, wanted to know what it would feel like to kill a black man. And so there's a great irony in terms of the day he was killed, because it was on the very same day that the legendary Jesse Owens from Ohio State had set four world track records in Ann Arbor during a Saturday in May. And that later that day, just 15, 20 miles away, the Black Legion lures Silas Coleman out to nearby Pinckney, where there's a dozen Black Legion guys who are having a drinking party. And, they're going to have some fun. That's literally how they worded it. We're going to have some fun, boys. And they take Silas Coleman out to the Ford Mill Pond, and, you know, he realizes at some point what's happening. He's running for his life, and he gets shot and killed there. And this is before the Black Legion, a year before the Black Legion will be exposed. Local police, Detroit police, say the guy who was killed is a Detroiter. They just figure it was other blacks who killed him, and they don't investigate. They're not concerned about it. It was definitely a different level of treatment at the time. And so they don't do anything about it. And so, in one respect, you might have somebody looking at the day's earlier proceedings with Jesse Owens, and at the same time Joe Lewis is on the rise, and you have these two fine African-American athletes that, you know, a lot of white America is rooting for, and they're kind of breaking some barriers in terms of how people view blacks. And then, you know, not 12 hours later, somebody being killed just for pleasure, just because of the color of his skin, and it's a heartbreaking story in that respect. And you know, one of the little sidelights to it is once the Black Legion gets exposed, Dayton Dean will tell the police that I've been told that there's 6-7 other bodies that are in that pond, that there's a sinkhole out there where they would wait and throw some of their victims. And there was initially a push by one state police figure, who really is one of the heroes of the book, Ira Marmon, Captain Ira Marmon. He wanted the pond drained, but Henry Ford's company refused to allow their pond to be drained. And there were other reasons, too. It affected farms, or so they said. But there was also the fact that during the Depression, a lot of these Legionnaires were employed in the auto factories. It was estimated that at Ford's massive River Rouge plant that some departments had a majority of members who were actually in the Black Legion. And you see a little bit of that represented in the movie that was made about the Legion back in 1936, starring Humphrey Bogart. They kind of represent that end of it. It's not a terribly accurate movie, but Nonetheless, the fact that a couple movies were made and radio series were made give you a sense of the hysteria that followed once it exposed, once the Legion was exposed, and people started learning that their neighbors and even their fathers or sons or husbands were members of the Legion, because often the family itself didn't know.
The book is Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. Henry Ford is just one of the many famous people that flickers across the pages here. We have cameo appearances by future presidents, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan. Of course, we haven't even mentioned Father Coughlin, who was a very famous person in America back in the 30s. I think we have just enough time to talk about him a little bit.
Sure, yeah. Reagan and Ford both make cameos, as you mentioned. Ford is a football player and Reagan is a young Chicago Cubs announcer. But Coughlin is by far just a spectacular figure, very interesting. This is the heyday of radio, of course, and he is a priest who is becoming increasingly political. He starts out worried about social justice issues and then gets involved endorsing Roosevelt and turns against Roosevelt. And we're starting to see glimmers by 35 and 36 of his anti-Semitism. It doesn't come into full force until later in the decade, but his following is incredible. It's average, you know, his average weekly listenership is 10 million, 20 million, peaks at probably 30, 40 million. His mail is so considerable that the government locates a post office in Royal Oak, Michigan, where his shrine is based, and people are making pilgrimages to his shrine, which is growing larger, you know, and they've got a huge statue before they have the massive church that they will build. And, yes, tons of money flowing in. And he initially, it's believed, was a target of the Legion. Dayton Dean goes to some meetings of the National Union that Coughlin has created to affect the presidential race. In fact, they will run a candidate. You see echoes. There's a lot of echoes of today's society in the story. And, you know, he can fill Madison Square Garden when he speaks. And he was in Cleveland at the big park there and had, you know, 15,000 people, I believe, plus Detroit and other cities. And masses come out to see him. And but he's becoming, you're getting hints of the anti-Semitism that he's going to become famous for and which will eventually lead him off the radio. But that's still a few years away. And so early on, he's just this powerful figure who's exerting his power, you know. Meeting with one of Roosevelt's representatives. I mean, he met with Roosevelt, too, but meeting with Joe Kennedy. And they're trying to make peace before the 36 election with him. They're worried, the Roosevelts, and actually Republicans are worried, too, that Coughlin is going to team up with Huey Long and either run for president together or as a team, or run some candidate in some joint party. Of course, Huey Long would get assassinated, but and Coughlin's candidate won't do as well as expected. But Dayton Dean initially is assigned to target him, and there is a fire at the original Shrine Shrine Church at this point, and that was never resolved in terms of the cause, and which might have been related to the Legion, but When Dayton Dean's going to the meetings, he is actually falling in love with some of what Coughlin says, so it's kind of an odd situation.
Well, it's quite a chunk of history in tumultuous times. You mentioned the assassination of Huey Long and a potential plot against Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Of course, there was an attempt on him in which the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak, was actually killed. And oh, gosh, just an amazing piece of history here. Terror in the City of Champions. Tom Stanton has been my guest. Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. We really appreciate your time, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Vic. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.